in suspension for one weightless instant, and then they descended, a hard drop, their bodies jamming together as the ropes compressed them into a single, twisting, captive mass. Peter was upside down. Somebody, Hollis, was on top of him. Hollis, and also Sarah, and a sneaker close to his face, which he recognized as Amy's. It was impossible to tell where one body ended and the next began. They were spinning like a top. His chest was compressed so tightly he could barely breathe. The skin of his cheek was pressed against the ropes, which were made of some heavy, fibrous twine. The ground was twirling under him, a rush of undifferentiated color.
"Leash! I can't move! Can anyone?"
"Michael."
"I think I'm going to be sick."
"Sarah," her voice shrill with panic.
"Michael, don't you dare!"
There was no way Peter could reach his blade. Even if he could have, severing the ropes would have sent them all plunging headlong to the ground. The spinning motion slowed, then stopped, then started again, its velocity increasing as they were flung in the opposite direction. Somewhere above him in the jumble of bodies, he heard Michael retch. They spun and spun and spun some more. It was on the sixth rotation that Peter detected, from the corner of his rolling eye, a tremulous motion in the brush. Like the woods were moving, coming to life. But by then he was too disoriented to speak. Part of him felt fear, but the rest of him could not seem to find this part.
"Holy goddamn," a voice below them said. "They're Strags."
And then Peter saw. They were soldiers. Chapter 58. In the first days, Mausami slept. 16, 18, 20 hours at a stretch. Theo had chased the mice away from the upstairs bedroom, whisking them down the stairs and out the door with a broom and a great deal of yelling. In a closet they had found, folded with an eerie care, smelling of thyme and dust, a pile of sheets and blankets, even a couple of pillows, one for her head and a second to fold between her knees to straighten her back. Random electric currents, exquisitely painful, had begun to shoot down one of her legs, the baby compressing her spine. She took it as a sign that the baby was doing what it was supposed to do, making space for himself in the densely packed room of her body. Theo came and went, fussing over her like a nurse, bringing her meals and water. He slept during the afternoons on the old saggy sofa downstairs, and when evening fell, he dragged a chair out to the porch, where he sat through the night, a shotgun on his lap, staring into the dark. Then one morning she awoke to a fresh, new vigor coursing through her. The drought of energy was over. The days of rest had done their work. She drew up to a sitting position and saw that the sun was shining in the window. The air was cool and dry, pushing a gentle breeze that shifted in the curtains. She did not remember opening the window, but perhaps Theo had done this sometime in the night. The baby was sitting on her bladder. Theo had left a pail for her, but she didn't want to use this, now that she no longer needed to. She would make the long march to the privy to show Theo that she was finally awake. Even now she could detect his movements somewhere in the house below. She rose, pulled a sweater over her long-tailed shirt. She was suddenly much too big for the only pair of gaps she had, and descended the stairs. Her center of gravity seemed to have shifted overnight. The frank bulge of her stomach made her feel top-heavy and clumsy. She supposed this was just something to get used to. Not even 6 months, and here she was, huge already. She stepped into a room she barely remembered. It took her a moment to absorb the fact that a great deal had changed. The sofa and chairs, which before had been pushed against the walls, now stood in the middle of the room at right angles to the fireplace, facing one another. Between them rested a small wooden table atop a threadbare woolen rug. The floor under her bare feet was free of dirt, swept clean. Theo had laid more blankets over the sofa, tucking the edges in, to cover the places where it was worn through and stained. But what drew her attention were the pictures propped on the mantel. A series of yellowed photographs. The same people, at different ages and in different configurations, all posed before the very house in which she now stood. A man and his wife and three children, a boy and two girls. The photos seemed to have been taken at intervals of a year. In each, the children had grown. The youngest, a baby in the first photograph, held in his mother's arms, a tired-looking woman wearing a pair of dark glasses perched above her forehead, was by the final image a boy of 5 or 6. He was standing in front of his older sisters, grinning greedily for the camera, showing the gap in his smile where he had lost a tooth. His t-shirt read, incomprehensibly, Utah Jazz. They're something, aren't they? Malsami turned to discover Theo observing her from the kitchen door.
Where did you find them?
He approached the mantel and took the last photograph with the smiling boy in his hands. They were in a crawl space under the stairs. See this here? He tapped the glass to show her. In the background, at the edge of the photo, an automobile, packed to the tops of its windows with more belongings lashed to the roof. It's the same car we found in the barn. Malsami regarded the photos another moment. How happy they all looked. Not just the smiling boy, but his parents and sisters as well. All of them. You think they lived here? Theo nodded, returning the picture to its place on the mantel with the others. My guess is they came here before the outbreak and got stranded. Or else they just decided to stay on. And don't forget the 4 graves out back. Malsami was about to point out that there were 4 graves, not 5. But then she realized her error. The 4th grave would have been dug by the last survivor, who couldn't bury himself. Hungry? Theo asked her. She ran a hand through her dirty hair. What I'd really like is a bath. As it happens, I thought you might. He was wearing a sly smile. Come on. He led her out to the yard. A large cast-iron pot now hung from a length of chain over a pile of glowing embers. Beside it was a metal trough, long and deep enough for a person to sit in. He used a plastic bucket to fill the trough with water from the pump, then, gripping the handle with a heavy cloth, lifted the metal pot and poured the steaming contents into the trough as well. Go on. Get in, Theo said. She felt suddenly embarrassed. It's okay, he said, laughing gently. I won't watch. It seemed foolish, after everything, to be shy about her body. And yet she was. With Theo's eyes averted, she removed her clothing quickly, standing naked for a moment in the autumn sunshine. The air was cold against her tightening skin, the taut, round shape of her belly. She eased herself into the water, which rose to cover her stomach, her swollen breasts, laced with a nimbus of blue veins. Okay if I turn around. I feel so huge, Theo. I can't believe you want to see me like this. You'll get bigger before you get smaller. Might as well get used to it. What was she afraid of? They could have a baby together, but she wouldn't let him see her naked? They hadn't so much as touched in days. She realized she had been waiting for him to do this, to cross the barrier that separated them, now that they were alone. It's okay. You can turn around. For a moment, his eyebrows raised at the sight of her. But just a moment. She saw that he was holding a blackened fry pan full of some hard, glistening substance. He placed it on the ground by the trough and knelt to carve a wedge-shaped piece with his blade. My God, Theo. You made soap? I used to make it with my mother sometimes. I don't know if I used enough ash, though. The fat comes from a pronghorn I shot yesterday morning. They're lean sons of bitches, but I got enough to render one batch. You shot a pronghorn? He nodded. It was hell dragging him back here, too, he said. At least 5 clicks. And there's lots of fish in the river. I'm figuring we can put up enough stores to make it through the winter easy. He rose, dusting his hands on his trouser legs. Go ahead and finish, and I'll make breakfast. By the time she was done, the water was opaque with dirt and filmed with grease from the soap. She rose to her feet and used the rest of the heated water to rinse herself off, standing naked in the yard to let the sun dry her, feeling the moisture wicking off her skin in the arid air. She couldn't remember when she'd felt so clean. She dressed. Her clothing felt filthy against her skin. She'd have to see about doing the laundry, and re-entered the house. More surprises from the basement. Theo had set the table. Actual china, laid out with utensils and drinking cups, the glass murky with age. He was cooking some kind of steak in a fry pan, with translucent slivers of onion. The room was roaring with heat from the stove, fueled by logs taken from a pile he'd stacked at the door. "The last of the antelope," he explained. "The rest is up for smoking." He flipped the steaks and turned toward her, drying his hands on a rag. "It's a little stringy, but not bad. There's wild onions down by the river, and bushes I think may be blackberries, though we'll have to wait till spring."
"Flyers, Theo. What else?"
The question wasn't serious. She was amazed at all he'd done. "Potatoes."
"Potatoes?"
"They're mostly gone to seed now, but we can still use some. I've moved a bunch down to the bins in the cellar." With a long fork, he speared the steaks onto their plates. "We won't starve. There's lots once you look." After breakfast, he washed the dishes in the sink while she watched. She wanted to help, but he insisted that she do nothing. "Feel up to a walk?" he asked. He disappeared into the barn and returned with a bucket and a pair of fishing poles, still strung with plastic monofilament. He gave her a small spade and the shotgun to carry and a handful of shells. By the time they reached the river, the sun was high in the sky. They were at a spot where the river slowed and widened into a broad, shallow bend. The banks were dense with vegetation, tall weeds golden with autumnal color. Theo had no hooks, but had found, tucked in a kitchen drawer, a small sewing kit containing a tin of safety pins. While Mouse dug in the dirt for worms, Theo tied these to the ends of their lines.
"So, how do you fish exactly?" Mouse said.
Her hands were full of wriggling dirt. Everywhere she looked, the ground was teeming with life. "I think you just put them in the water and see what happens." They did. But after a while this seemed silly. Their hooks were sitting in the shallows where they could see them. "Stand back," Theo said. "I'm going to try to get mine farther out." He drew back the latch on his reel, lifted the rod over his shoulder, and threw the line forward. It shot out in a long arc over the water, disappearing into the current with a plunk. Almost at once, the tip of the rod bent sharply.
"Shit!"
His eyes went wide with panic.
"What do I do? Don't let him get away!"
The fish broke the surface with a shimmering splash. Theo began to reel him in.
"He feels huge!"
As Theo pulled the fish toward shore, Mouse stumbled into the shallows. The water was astonishingly cold, filling her boots, and bent to grab him. He darted away, and in another moment her ankles were all wrapped up in the fishing line.
"Theo, help!"
They were both laughing. Theo snatched the fish and rolled him onto his back, which seemed to have the desired effect. The fish gave up his struggles. Mouse managed to untangle herself and retrieved the bucket from shore while Theo pulled the fish from the river. A long, glimmering thing, like a single slab of muscle flecked with brilliant color, as if hundreds of tiny gems were set into its flesh. The pin was hooked through its lower lip, the worm still on it.
"What part do you eat?" Mouse asked.
"I guess that depends on how hungry we get." He kissed her then. She felt a flood of happiness. He was still Theo. Her Theo. She could feel it in his kiss. Whatever had happened in that cell hadn't taken this away from her. "My turn," she said, pushing him away, and took up her rod to cast as he had done. They filled the bucket with wriggling fish. The abundance of the river seemed almost too much, like an overly extravagant present. The wide blue sky and the sun-dappled river and the forgotten countryside and the two of them together in it. It all seemed somehow miraculous. Walking back to the house, Mouse found her mind returning to the family in the pictures. The mother and the father and the two girls and the boy with his victorious gap-toothed smile. They had lived here, died here. But most of all, she felt certain, they had lived. They cleaned the fish and set the tender meat on racks in the smokehouse. Tomorrow they would take them out to dry in the sun. One they saved for dinner and cooked it in the pan with a bit of onion and one of the seedy potatoes. As the sun was setting, Theo took up the shotgun from its place in the corner of the kitchen. Mouse was putting the last of the dishes away in the cabinets. She turned to see him ejecting the shells, three of them, into his palm, blowing on each to clean the cap of dust, then sliding them back into the magazine. Next, he removed his blade and cleaned this also, wiping it on his pants. Well, he cleared his throat. I guess it's time.
No, Theo.
She put down the plate she was holding and stepped toward him, taking the gun from his hands and placing it on the kitchen table.
We're safe here. I know it.
Even as she said the words, she felt their veracity. They were safe because she believed they were safe.
Don't go.
He shook his head. I don't think that's such a good idea, Mouse. She leaned her face into his and kissed him again, long and slow, so he would know this about her, about both of them. They were safe. Inside her, the baby had begun to hiccup.
Come to bed, Theo, said Masami. Please. I want you to come to bed with me. Now.
It was sleep he feared. He told her that night as they lay curled together. He couldn't not sleep, he knew that. Not sleeping was like not eating, he explained, or not breathing. It was like holding your breath in your chest as long as you could until motes of light were dancing before your eyes and every part of you was saying one word, breathe. That's what it had been like in the cell, for days and days and days. And now, the dream was gone, but not the feeling of it. The fear that he would close his eyes and find himself in the dream again. Because at the end, if not for the girl, he would have done it. She'd come into the dream and stayed his hand, but by then, it was too late. He would have killed the woman, killed anyone. He would have done whatever they wanted. And once you knew that about yourself, he said, you could never unknow it. Whoever you thought you were somebody else entirely. She held him as he spoke, his voice drifting in the darkness, and then for a long time both of them were silent. Mouse, are you awake?
I'm right here.
Though this wasn't so, she had in fact dozed off. He shifted against her, pulling her arm over his chest like a blanket to keep him warm.
Stay awake for me, he said.
Can you do that?
Until I'm asleep.
Yes, she said.
Yes, I can do that.
He was quiet for a while. In the marginless space between their bodies, the baby flipped and kicked.
We're safe here, Theo, she said. As long as we're together, we'll be safe.
I hope that's true, he said.
I know it's true, Masami said.
But even as she felt his breathing slow against her, sleeping taking him at last, she kept her eyes open, staring into the dark.
It's true, she thought. Because it has to be.
Chapter 59. By the time they reached the garrison, it was mid-afternoon. Their packs had been returned, but not their weapons. They were not prisoners, but neither were they free to go as they wished. The term the major had used was under protection. From the river, they had marched straight north over the ridge. At the base of a second valley, they'd come to a muddy trace, rutted with hoof prints and tire tracks. It was sheer chance that they had missed it on their own. Heavy clouds had moved in from the west. The air looked and felt like rain. As the first spits commenced to fall, Peter tasted wood smoke in the wind. Major Greer came up beside him. He was a tall, well-built man with a brow so furrowed it looked plowed. He might have been 40 years old. He was dressed in loose-fitting camouflage spattered in a pattern of green and brown, drawn tight at the waist by a wide belt, pockets fat with gear. His head, covered by a woolen cap, was shaved clean. Like all his men, a squad of 15, he'd painted his face with streaks of mud and charcoal, giving the whites of his eyes a startling vividness. They looked like wolves, like creatures of the forest. They looked like the forest itself. A long-range patrol unit. They had been in the woods for weeks. Greer paused on the path and shouldered his rifle. A black pistol was holstered at his waist. He took a long drink from his canteen and waved it toward the hillside. They were close now. Peter could feel it in the quickening step of Greer's men. A hot meal? A cot to sleep on? A roof over their heads?
"Just over the next ridge," Greer said.
In the intervening hours they had formed something that felt to Peter like the beginnings of a friendship. After the initial confusion of their capture, a situation compounded by the fact that neither group would agree to say who they were until the other blinked first, it was Michael who had broken the stalemate, lifting his vomit-smeared face from the dirt where the net had disgorged them to proclaim, "Oh, fuck! I surrender! We're from California, all right? Somebody please just shoot me so the ground will stop spinning!" As Greer capped his canteen, Alicia caught up to them on the path. From the start, she had been unusually silent. She'd voiced no objection to Greer's order that they travel unarmed, a fact that now struck Peter as completely out of character. But probably she was just in shock, as they all were. For the duration of the march to camp, she had kept protectively to Amy's side. Perhaps, Peter thought, she was simply embarrassed that she'd led them straight into the soldier's trap. As for Amy, the girl seemed to have absorbed this new turn of events as she absorbed everything, with a neutral, watchful countenance. "What's it like?" he asked Greer. The major shrugged.
"Just like you'd think.
It's like a big latrine. It beats being out in the rain, though." As they crested the hill, nestled in a bowl-like valley below them, the garrison leapt into view. A cluster of canvas tents and vehicles ringed by a fence of timbers, 15 meters tall at least, and each honed at the top to a sharp point. Among the vehicles, Peter saw at least half a dozen Humvees, 2 large tankers and a number of smaller trucks, pickups and 5 tons with heavy, mud-choked tires. At the perimeter, 12 large floodlights stood on tall poles. At the far end of the compound, horses were grazing in a paddock. More soldiers were moving among the buildings and along a catwalk at the top of the wall. At the center of the compound, standing over all, a large flag flapped in the wind, blocks of red, white, and blue with a single white star. The whole thing couldn't have been more than 1/2 square kilometer, and yet, standing on the ridge, Peter felt as if he were gazing into an entire city, the heart of a world he'd always believed in, but never actually imagined.
"They've got lights," said Michael.
More men from Greer's unit moved past them, headed down the hill.
"Hail, son," said the one named Muncie,
a corporal, bald as the rest of them, with a wide, snaggle-toothed smile. Most of Greer's men bore themselves with a soldierly silence, speaking only when spoken to, but not Muncie, who chattered like a bird. His job, fittingly, was to operate the radio, which he carried on his back, a mechanism with a generator run by a hand crank, which stuck from the bottom like a tail.
"Inside that fence," Muncie said with a grin. "That dirt is Texas. If we ain't got it, you don't need it."
They weren't regular army, Greer had explained. At least not the U.S. Army. There was no U.S. Army anymore.
"Then whose army are you?" Peter had asked.
That was when Greer had told them about Texas. By the time they reached the base of the hill, a crowd of men had gathered. Despite the cold, and now the rain, a pattering drizzle, some were bare-chested, exposing their narrow waists, the densely ribboned muscles of their shoulders and chests. All were smooth-shaven, their heads too. Everyone was armed, rifles and pistols, even a few crossbows. "Folks'll stare," Greer said quietly. "You better get used to it." "How many strags do you usually bring in?" Peter asked. The term, Greer had explained, was short for stragglers. Greer frowned. They were moving toward the gate. "None. Farther east, you still get some. Up in Oklahoma, 3rd Battalion once found a whole goddamn town. But way out here, we're not even looking."
"Then what was the net for?"
"Sorry," Greer said. "I thought you understood. That's for the drags. What you all call smokes." He twirled a finger in the air. "That twisting motion messes with their heads. They're like ducks in a barrel in that thing." Peter recalled something Caleb had told him about why the virals stayed out of the turbine field. Xander always said the movement screwed them up. He related this to Greer.
"Makes sense," the major agreed. "They don't like spinning. I haven't heard that about turbines, though."
Michael was walking beside them.
"So what were those things? Hanging in the trees with the bad smell?"
"Garlic." Greer gave a little laugh. "Oldest trick in the book. The fucking Drax love it." The conversation was cut short as they stepped through the gate into a tunnel of waiting men. Greer's squad had dispersed among the crowd. No one was talking. As Peter passed, he saw their eyes darting quickly over him. That was when he realized what the soldiers were all looking at. They were looking at the women.
"Tension!"
Everyone snapped to. Peter saw a figure stepping briskly toward them from one of the tents. At first glance, he was not what Peter would have expected of a high-ranking military officer. An almost barrel-shaped man, a full head shorter than Greer, with a waddling, round-heeled gait. Under the dome of his shorn head, the features of his face seemed scrunched, as if they had been placed too close together. But as he approached, Peter felt the force of his authority, a mysterious energy, like a zone of static electricity that hovered in the air around him. His eyes, small and dark, possessed a frank, piercing intensity, even if, as it appeared, they had been incongruously set in the wrong face. He regarded Peter a long moment, his hands on his hips, then looked past him toward the others, holding each briefly with the same evaluating gaze.
"I'll be goddamned."
His voice was surprisingly deep. He spoke with the same loose-jawed accent as Greer and his men.
"At ease, all of you."
Everyone relaxed. Peter didn't know what to say. Best, he thought, to wait to hear from this man first.
"Men of the Second," he declared, lifting his voice to the gathered men, "it has come to my attention that some of these strags are women. You are not to look at these women. You are not to speak to them or come near them or approach them or in any way think you have anything to do with them or they with you. They are not your girlfriends or your wives. They are not your mothers or your sisters. They are nothing. They do not exist. They are not here. Am I clear?"
"Sir, yes, sir."
Peter glanced at Alicia, where she was standing with Amy, but couldn't meet her eye. Hollis shot him a skeptical frown. Clearly he had no idea what to make of this either.
"You six, drop your packs and come with me. Major, you too."
They followed him into the tent, a single room with an earthen floor beneath a sagging canvas ceiling. The only furnishings were a pot-bellied stove, a pair of plywood trestle tables covered with papers, and along the far wall, a smaller table with a radio manned by a soldier with earphones clamped to the sides of his head. On the wall above him was a large multicolored map, marked with dozens of beaded pins forming an irregular V. As Peter moved closer, he saw that the base of the V was in central Texas, with one arm reaching north across Oklahoma and into southern Kansas, the other veering west into New Mexico, before it too turned north, ending just across the Colorado border, the place where he now stood. At the top of the map, written in yellow on a dark stripe, were the words, United States Intermediate Political, and beneath that, Fox and Sons Classroom Maps, Cincinnati, Ohio. Greer came up beside him. Welcome to the war, he murmured. The commander, who had entered behind them, directed his voice to the radio operator, who, as the man outside had, was staring frankly at the women. He seemed to have chosen Sarah, but then his eyes moved to Alicia, then Amy, in a series of nervous jerks. Corporal, excuse us, please. With obvious effort, he broke his gaze away, pulling the earphones from his head. His face bloomed with embarrassment.
Sir. Sorry, sir.
Now, son. The corporal got to his feet and scampered away. So. The commander's eyes settled on Greer. Major, is there something you neglected to tell me?
Three of the strags are women, sir.
Yes. Yes, they are. Thank you for letting me know.
Sorry, General. He seemed to wince. We should have called that in.
Yes, you should have. Since you found them, I'm putting you in charge. Think you can handle that?
Of course, sir. No problem.
Put together a detail. Get them billeted. They'll need their own latrine, too.
Yes, General.
Go. Greer nodded, glancing quickly toward Peter. Good luck, his eyes seemed to say, and exited the tent. The general, whose name Peter realized he had yet to learn, took another moment to look them over. Now that they were alone, his bearing had relaxed.
Here, Jackson.
Peter nodded.
I'm Brigadier General Curtis Voorhees, 2nd Expeditionary Forces, Army of the Republic of Texas.
A hint of a smile.
I'm the big dog around here. In case that was something else Major Greer neglected to mention.
He didn't, sir. I mean, he did mention it.
Good.
Voorhees nodded, regarding them all another moment.
So, am I to understand, and forgive me if I seem incredulous on this point, that the six of you walked all the way from California?
Actually, Peter thought, we drove some of the way. For some of it, we took a train. But instead, he simply answered, yes, sir.
And why, may I ask, would anyone attempt such a thing?
Peter opened his mouth to reply. But once again, the answer, the true one, seemed too large. Outside, the rain had begun to fall in earnest, drumming on the tent's canvas roof.
It's a long story, he managed.
Well, I'm sure it is, Mr. Jackson. And I'd be very interested to hear it. For now, we need to concern ourselves with a few preliminaries. You are civilian guests of the 2nd Expeditionary. For the duration of your stay, you're under my authority. Think you can live with that?
Peter nodded.
In another 6 days, this unit will be moving south to rendezvous with 3rd Battalion at the town of Roswell, New Mexico. From there, we can send you back to Kerrville with a supply convoy. I suggest you take this offer, but this is entirely your choice. No doubt it is something you will wish to discuss among yourselves.
Peter broke his gaze away to look at the others, whose faces seemed to mirror his own surprise. He hadn't considered the possibility that their journey might be over.
Now, as for the other matter, Voorhees went on, which you heard me speak of with the Major, I will need you to instruct the women in your party that they are not to have any contact with my men beyond what is absolutely necessary. They are to remain in their tent except to go to the latrine. Any needs they have are to go through you or Major Greer. Is this clear?
Peter had no reason to refuse, other than the fact that the offer struck him as plainly ridiculous.
I'm not sure I can tell them that, sir.
You can't?
No, sir.
He shrugged. There were no other words for it.
We're all together.
That's just how it is. The general sighed.
Perhaps you misunderstood me. I am asking only as a courtesy. The mission of the Second Expeditionary is such that it would be completely improper, even dangerous for them to move freely among the unit.
Why would they be in danger?
He frowned. They wouldn't. It's not the women I'm thinking of.
Voorhees took a patient breath and began again.
I will explain this as simply as I know how. We are a volunteer force. To join the expeditionary is to do so for life by blood oath, and each of these men is sworn to die. He's cut all ties to the world but this unit and the men within it. Each time a man leaves this compound, he wholly believes he'll never come back. He accepts this. More than that, he embraces it. A man will happily die for his friends. But a woman? A woman makes him want to live. Once that happens, I promise you, he'll walk through that gate and never come back.
Voorhees was talking, Peter understood, about giving it up. But after all they had been through, it was simply impossible to imagine telling any of them, Alicia especially, that they would have to hide in their tent.
I'm sure all of these women are fine fighters, Voorhees continued. You couldn't have made it this far if they weren't. But our code is very strict, and I need you to respect it. If you can't, I will return your weapons and send you on your way.
Fine, he said. We'll go.
Wait, Peter.
It was Alicia who had spoken. Peter turned to face her.
Leash, it's all right. I'm with you on this. He says we go, we'll go.
But Alicia didn't acknowledge him. Her eyes were pointed at the general. Peter realized she was standing at attention, her arms held rigidly at her sides.
General Voorhees, Colonel Niles Coffee of the First Expeditionary sends his regards.
Niles Coffee?
A light seemed to come on in his face.
The Niles Coffee?
Leash, Peter said, her meaning dawning upon him. Do you mean the Colonel?
But Alicia said nothing. She didn't even look at him. Her expression was set in a way that Peter had never seen before.
Young lady, Colonel Coffee was lost with all his men 30 years ago.
Not true, sir, Alicia said. He survived.
Coffee's alive?
KIA, sir. 3 months ago.
Voorhees glanced around the room before finding Alicia with his eyes again.
And who, may I ask, are you?
She gave a crisp nod from her chin.
His adopted daughter, sir. Private Alicia Donadio, First Expeditionary. Baptized and sworn.
No one spoke. Something final was occurring, Peter knew. Something irrevocable. He felt a wave of disorienting panic rising inside him, as if some basic fact of his life, fundamental as gravity, had been suddenly and without warning stripped away.
Leash, what are you saying?
At last she turned her face to look at him. Her eyes were pooled with trembling tears.
Oh, Peter,
she said, as the first one broke away to descend her dirt-stained cheek.
I'm sorry. I really should have told you. You can't have her!
I'm sorry, Jackson, the general said. This isn't your decision to make.
It's no one's decision. He stepped briskly to the door of the tent.
Greer! Somebody get Major Greer to my tent now!
What's going on? Michael demanded. Peter, what is she talking about?
Suddenly everybody was speaking at once. Peter gripped Alicia by the arms, making her look at him.
Leash, what are you doing? Think about what you're doing.
It's already done.
Through her tears, her face seemed to glow with relief, as if a burden long carried had finally been put to rest.
It was done before I knew you. Long before. The day the Colonel came into the sanctuary to claim me. He made me promise not to tell.
He understood, then, what she'd been trying to say to him that morning.
You were tracking them.
She nodded.
Yes. For the last 2 days.
When I was scouting downstream, I found one of their camps. The ashes of their fire were still warm. Way out here, I didn't think it could be anybody else. She shook her head faintly.
Honestly, Peter, I didn't know if I even wanted to find them. Part of me always thought they were just an old man's stories. You have to believe that.
Greer appeared at the door of the tent, dripping with rain. Major Greer, the general said, this woman is first expeditionary. Greer's jaw fell open.
She's what?
Niles Coffey's daughter. Greer stared at Alicia, his eyes wide with shock, as if he were looking at some strange animal.
Holy goddamn! Coffey had a daughter?
She says she's sworn. Greer scratched his bare head in puzzlement.
Christ! She's a woman. What do you want to do?
There's nothing to do. Sworn is sworn. The men will have to learn to live with it. Take her to the barber. Get her assigned. It was all happening too fast. Peter felt as if something huge were breaking open inside him.
Leash, tell them you're lying.
I'm sorry. This is how it has to be.
Major? Greer nodded, his face grave, and stepped to her side.
You can't leave me,
Peter heard himself say, though the voice that spoke these words did not seem to be his own.
I have to, Peter. It's who I am.
He had, without realizing it, stepped into her arms. He felt the tears in his throat.
I can't do this without you.
Yes, you can. I know you can.
It was no use. Alicia was leaving him. He felt her slipping away.
I can't. I can't.
It's all right,
she said, her voice close to his ear.
Hush now.
She held him that way a long moment, the two of them wrapped in a bubble of silence, as if they were alone. Then Alicia took his face in her hands and bent him toward her. She kissed him, once and quickly, on the forehead. A kiss that both sought forgiveness and bestowed it. A kiss of goodbye. The air parted between them. She had released him, stepping away.
Thank you, General, she said. Major Greer, I'm ready now.
Chapter 60 The days of rain. Peter told them everything. For 5 full days the rain poured down. He sat for hours at the long table in Voorhees's tent, sometimes just the two of them, but usually with Greer as well. He told them about Amy and the colony and the signal they had come to find. He told them about Theo and Masami and the Haven and all that had happened there. He told them that 1,600 kilometers away on a mountaintop in California, 90 souls were waiting for the lights to go out. I won't lie to you, Voorhees said when Peter asked them if they could send the soldiers there. It was late afternoon. Alicia had left in the morning on patrol. Just like that, she had been subsumed into the life of Voorhees's men. It's not that I don't believe you, Voorhees explained, and this bunker of yours alone sounds like it would be worth the trip. But I'll have to take this up the line, and that means division. It would be next spring at the earliest before we could think about making such a trip. That's all uncharted ground.
I'm not sure they can wait that long.
Well, they'll have to. My biggest worry is getting out of this valley before the snow hits. This rain doesn't let up, we could get stuck here. There's only enough fuel to keep our lights going another 30 days.
What I want to know more about is this place, the Haven, Greer cut in.
Outside the walls of the tent and in the presence of any of the men, Greer's and Voorhees's relationship was rigidly formal, but inside, as they were now, they visibly relaxed into friendship. Greer looked at the general, his eyes darkening thoughtfully.
Sounds a little like those folks in Oklahoma.
What folks? Peter asked.
Place called Homer, Voorhees replied, picking up the thread. 3rd Battalion came across them about 10 years ago, way the hell and gone out in the panhandle. A whole town of survivors, over 1,100 men, women, and children. I wasn't there, but I heard the stories. It was like stepping back 100 years. They didn't even seem to know what the Drax were. Just going about their business, nice as you please, no lights or fencing. Happy to see you, but don't slam the door on your way out. The CO offered them transport, but they said no thanks, and in any case, the 3rd wasn't really equipped to move that many bodies south to Kerrville. It was the damnedest thing. Survivors, and they didn't want to be rescued. 3rd Battalion left a squad behind and moved on north up to Wichita, where they got their happy asses handed to them. Lost half their men. The rest hightailed it back. When they got there, the place was empty.
What do you mean empty? Peter asked.
Voorhees's eyebrows lifted sharply. I mean empty. Not a soul and no bodies. Everything neat as a pin. Dinner dishes sitting on the table. No sign of the squad they'd left, either.
Peter had to admit it was puzzling, but he didn't see what this had to do with the Haven.
Maybe they decided to go somewhere safer, Peter offered.
Maybe.
Maybe the Drax just took them so fast they didn't have time to wash the dishes.
You're asking something I don't know the answer to, but I will tell you this. 30 years ago, when Kerrville sent out the first expeditionary, you couldn't walk 100 meters without tripping over a Drac. The 1st lost half a dozen men on a good day, and when Coffey's unit disappeared, people pretty much thought it was over. I mean, the guy was a legend. The expeditionary more or less disbanded right then. But now, here you are, having traveled all the way from California. Back in the day, you wouldn't have made it 20 steps to the latrine.
Peter glanced at Greer, who acknowledged this truth with a nod, then looked back at Voorhees.
Are you saying they're dying off?
Oh, there's plenty, believe me. You just got to know where to look. What I'm saying is something's different. Something's changed. In the last 60 months, we've run 2 supply lines from Kerrville, one up as far as Hutchinson, Kansas, another through New Mexico into Colorado. What we've seen is that you tend to find them in clusters now. They're burrowing deeper, too, using mines, caves, places like that mountain you found. They're sometimes packed in there so tightly you'd need a crowbar to pry them apart. The cities are still crawling, with all the empty buildings, but there's plenty of open countryside where you could go for days without seeing one.
What about Kerrville? Why is that safe?
The general frowned. Well, it isn't. Not 100%. Most of Texas is pretty bad, actually. Laredo is no place you'd ever want to go, or Dallas. Houston, what's left of it, is like a goddamn bloodsucker swamp. The place is so polluted with petrochemicals, I don't know how they survive there, but they do. San Antonio and Austin were both pretty much leveled in the 1st war. El Paso, too. Fucking federal government, trying to burn the Drax out. That's what led to the Declaration, along about the same time California split off.
Split off? Peter asked.
Voorhees nodded. From the Union. Declared its independence. The California thing was a real bloodbath, pretty much open warfare for a while, like there wasn't anything else to worry about. But Texas got lost in the shuffle,
Maybe the Federals just didn't want to fight on two fronts. The governor seized all military assets, which wasn't hard, since the army by then was in total freefall, everything coming apart. They moved the capital to Kerrville and dug in. Walled it off, like your colony. But the difference is we had oil and lots of it. Down near Freeport, there's about 500 million barrels sitting in underground salt domes, the old Strategic Petroleum Reserve. You got oil, you got power. You got power, you got lights. We've got over 30,000 souls inside the walls, plus another 50,000 acres under irrigation and a fortified supply line running to a working refinery on the coast.
The coast, Peter repeated. The word felt heavy in his mouth.
You mean the ocean?
The Gulf of Mexico, anyway. Voorhees shrugged. Calling it the ocean would be polite. It's pretty much a chemical slick. All those offshore platforms still pumping the crap out, plus the discharge from New Orleans. Ocean currents pushed a lot of debris in through there, too. Tankers, cargo ships, you name it. In places you can practically walk across it without getting your feet wet.
But you could still leave from there, Peter tendered, if you had a boat.
In theory. But I wouldn't recommend it. The problem is getting past the barrier.
Mines, Greer explained.
Voorhees nodded. And lots of them. In the last days of the war, the NATO alliance, our so-called friends, banded together and made one last effort to contain the infection. Heavy bombing along the coasts, and not just conventional explosives. They blasted just about anything in the water. You can still see the wreckage down in Corpus. Then they laid mines, just to slam the door.
Peter remembered the stories his father had told him. The stories of the ocean and the long beach. The rusting ribs of the great ships stretching as far as the eye could see. Never had he thought to wonder how this had come about. He had lived in a world without history, without cause. A world where things just were what they were. Talking to Voorhees and Greer was like looking at lines on a page and suddenly seeing words written there.
What about farther east? He asked. Have you ever sent anybody there?
Voorhees shook his head. Not for years. The first expeditionary sent two battalions that way, one north into Louisiana through Shreveport, another across Missouri toward St. Louis. They never came back.
He shrugged.
Maybe someday. For now, Texas is what we've got.
I'd like to see it, Peter said after a moment. The city. Kerrville.
And you will, Peter. Voorhees allowed himself a rare smile. If you take that convoy. They had yet to give Voorhees an answer, and Peter felt torn. They had safety, they had lights, they had found the army after all. It might not be until spring, but Peter felt confident that Voorhees would send an expedition to the colony and bring the others in. They had found what they had come for, in other words. More than found it. To ask his friends to continue seemed like an unnecessary risk. And without Alicia, part of him wanted to say yes, to just let the whole thing be over. But whenever he thought this, his next thought would be of Amy. Alicia had been right. To come so close and turn away felt like something he would regret, probably for the rest of his life. Michael had tried to pick up the signal from the radio in the general's tent, but their radio equipment was all short-range, worthless in the mountains. In the end, Voorhees said he had no reason to doubt their story, but who knew what the signal meant? The military left all kinds of crap behind. Civilians, too. Believe me, we've seen it before. You can't go chasing every squeak. He spoke with the weariness of a man who had seen a lot, more than enough. This girl of yours, Amy. Maybe she's 100 years old, like you say, and maybe she isn't. I have no reason to disbelieve you, except for the fact that she looks about 15 and scared shitless. You can't always explain these things. My guess is she's just some poor traumatized soul who survived somehow, and by a stroke of luck just wandered into your camp.
What about the transmitter in her neck?
Well, what about it? Voorhees's tone wasn't mocking, merely factual. Hell, maybe she's Russian or Chinese. We've been waiting for those people to show up, assuming there's even anyone left alive out there.
Is there?
Voorhees paused. He and Greer exchanged a look of caution. The truth is, we don't know. Some people say the quarantine worked, that the rest of the world is just humming right along out there without us. This raises the question as to why we wouldn't hear anything over the wireless, but I suppose it's possible they set up some kind of electronic barricade in addition to the mines. Others believe, and I think the Major and I share this opinion, that everybody's dead. This is all conjecture, mind you, but the story goes that the quarantine wasn't quite as tight as people thought. 5 years after the outbreak, the continental United States was pretty much depopulated, ripe for the picking. The gold depository at Fort Knox, the vault at the Federal Reserve in New York, every museum and jewelry shop and bank right down to the corner savings and loan, all just sitting there, nobody minding the store. But the real prize was all that American military ordnance just lying around, including upwards of 10,000 nuclear weapons, any one of which could shift the balance of power in a world without the United States to babysit it. Frankly, I don't think it's a question of if anyone came ashore, but how many and who. Chances are, they took the virus back with them. Peter gave himself a moment to absorb all this, for he was telling him the world was empty. An empty place. I don't think Amy's here to steal anything, he said finally. If it's any help, I don't think so either. She's just a kid, Peter. How she survived out there is anybody's guess. Maybe she'll find a way to tell you. I think she already has. That's what you believe, and I won't disagree with you. But I'll tell you something else. I knew a woman growing up. Crazy old lady lived in a shack behind our housing section, an old falling-down dump of a place. Wrinkled as a raisin, kept about 100 cats, place absolutely reeked of cat piss. This woman claimed she could hear what the Drax were thinking. We kids would tease the hell out of her, though of course we couldn't get enough of her either. The kind of thing you feel bad about later, but not at the time. She was what you all call a walker. Just appeared at the gates one day. For he is concluded with a shrug. Time to time, you hear stories like this. Old people, mostly. Half-crazy mystics. Never a young one like this girl. But it's not a new story. Greer leaned forward. He seemed suddenly interested.
What happened to her?
The woman? The general rubbed his chin as he searched his memory. As I recall, she took the trip, hanged herself in her cat-piss-smelling house. When neither Peter nor Greer said anything, the general went on, "You can't overthink these things. Or at least we can't. I'm sure the Major will agree with me. We're here to clear out as many Drax as we can, lay in supplies, find the hot spots and burn them out. Maybe someday it'll all add up to something. I'm sure it's nothing I'll live to see." The general pushed back from the table, and Greer as well. The time for talk was over, at least for the day. "In the meantime, think about my offer, Jackson. A ride home. You've earned it." By the time Peter had stepped to the door, Greer and Voorhees were already leaning over the table, where a large map had been unrolled.
Voorhees raised his face, frowning. Was there something else?
It's just... What did he want to say?
I was wondering about Alicia. How she's doing. She's fine, Peter. However Coffee did it, he taught her well. You probably wouldn't even recognize her. He felt stung.
I'd like to see her.
I know you would. But it's just not a good idea right now. When Peter didn't move from the door, Voorhees said, with barely concealed impatience, Is that all? Peter shook his head. Just tell her I asked for her. I'll do that, son. Peter stepped through the flap into the darkening afternoon. The rain had let up, but the air felt completely saturated, heavy with bone-chilling dampness. Beyond the walls of the garrison, a dense fog bank was drifting over the ridge. Everything was spattered with mud. He hugged his jacket around himself as he crossed the open ground between Voorhees' tent and the mess hall, where he caught sight of Hollis, sitting alone at one of the long tables, spooning beans into his mouth from a battered plastic tray. More soldiers were scattered around the room, quietly talking. Peter fetched a tray and filled it from the pot and went to where Hollis was sitting. This seat taken? They're all taken, Hollis said glumly. They're just letting me borrow this one. Peter took a place on the bench. He knew what Hollis meant. They were like extra limbs here, something vestigial, with nothing to do, no role to play. Sarah and Amy had been relegated to their tent, but for all his relative freedom, Peter felt just as trapped. And none of the soldiers would have anything to do with them. The unstated assumption was that they had nothing worth saying and would be leaving soon anyway. He updated Hollis on all he had learned, then asked the question that was really on his mind. Any sign of her?
I saw them leaving this morning with Raimi's squad.
Raimi's unit, one of six, was doing short recon patrols to the southeast. When Peter had asked Voorhees how long they'd be gone, he had answered enigmatically, However long it takes.
How'd she look?
Like one of them?
Hollis paused.
I waved to her, but I don't think she saw me.
Know what they're calling her?
Peter shook his head.
The last expeditionary.
Hollis frowned at this.
Kind of a mouthful, if you ask me.
They fell silent. There was nothing more to say. If they were extra limbs, Alicia felt to Peter like a missing one. He kept looking for her in his mind, turning his thoughts to the place where Alicia should be. It wasn't the kind of thing he thought he could ever really get used to.
I don't think they really believe us about Amy, Peter said.
Would you?
Peter shook his head, conceding.